Good morning, church family, Redeemer Presbyterian Church. This morning we'll be going over week 4, which would be the recent controversies. So if you pull up your presentation, this would be slide number 30. And what we're going to go over this morning is the 1940s all the way up until the present age. So this will kind of cover most of the controversies in our life, or most of us perhaps experienced in our life in the local church. So this the first picture that I have in the slides this morning, slide number 30, is the Jesus freaks. And what I've always found interesting when I went to Dallas Theological Seminary is I had some friends whose parents, who are baby boomers, who went through this kind of tradition, so to speak. They would not call themselves a tradition, but I would very much call them a tradition. And I believe that, I can't remember the gentleman's name in the picture, but I think they're called Calvary Chapel. Again, if we were together, I could get perhaps some of you guys to correct me on this, but that was kind of a famous network of people that intentionally reached out to people that were in the drug and countercultural movement in the 1960s, and became the Jesus freaks. Notice how, again, they're kind of a parallel to the hippies, but they're called the so-called Jesus freaks. So that's kind of a watershed moment. The 1960s, I think most social historians really emphasize, those who are of a more conservative, socially conservative persuasion, such as we would be being in the EPC. But they really play up the 1960s as kind of being a watershed moment. So I think that picture is kind of a key for what even you can see them playing guitars. I mean, that sort of foreshadows to the contemporary movement in the local church. So it comes out in the 1960s. So slide number 31. So there's a picture of a young Billy Graham preaching Youth for Christ, which I know some of us were a part of when we were teenagers. But fundamentalism morphs through the influence of Billy Graham into what is called neo-evangelicalism. And neo-evangelicalism really had a shape and still continues to have a shape on Presbyterianism. So that's why I have to mention it. And Graham, if I'm correct, did grow up in a Presbyterian household. And I think his parents went to, the name of the city is escaping me. It might take me a second to remember. Montreat, North Carolina, where I know that's the home church of Andrew Brunson, but I believe Graham's parents went there for a while. Maybe Billy Graham even himself went there for a while. But he's kind of a figure that escapes denominationalism and eventually I think is ordained in the Baptist tradition. But Daryl Hart, who's one of my favorite church historians, has a really great quote about neo-evangelicalism. And it's meant to be tongue-in-cheek and quite funny, but I also think it's very much true. He says neo-evangelicalism has the same theology as fundamentalism. It's just nicer. And that's meant to be a joke. But in many ways, I actually think that that's correct. I think the theology is the same, but the means by which we do outreach to the world is different. And I would like to sometimes push back a little bit on neo-evangelicalism. And I think what it produces sometimes in the discipleship realm is people that are too this worldly. And I've been trying to push us against that to a more classical approach to formation, which is called the beatific vision. But I think neo-evangelicalism can be a little bit too consumed with this world. And some of the kind of funny things you can kind of see this pop up to is evangelicals raising support to go do outreach to movie stars, for example, in like the 1960s. I've read stories about this in the past, and it's just kind of kooky and a little bit weird, but it's kind of like, well, I have to go and do this, as opposed to Machen, which we learned about last week, who is more concerned with orthodoxy as defined historically, and he's also somebody that has a more churchly perspective. And I see personally a lot of younger ministers, including myself, kind of reacting against neo-evangelicalism and kind of trying to usher the church in a more traditionalist type of way of understanding formation, worship, preaching, and teaching and instructing discipleship, disciples. So during this time period, you have famous institutions that are founded. So Fuller Theological Seminary, which very much was founded to be the West Coast version of Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. You have Dallas Theological Seminary that's founded in the 1920s, but really starts to ramp up students coming into the institution in the 1940s as they come home from World War II. But these institutions, including another one that we might be familiar with called TEDS, or Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, are very much set up in the 1940s and after to rival institutions of the mainline. And that's one thing I want us to realize when we study, you know, evangelicalism. What's so interesting about it is because the Evangelical Presbyterian Church has a mixture of both mainline trained pastors and also has a mixture of people such as myself who come from these institutions that I just talked about. There actually is a real big difference in how one goes about theology or how about one runs the church based on where you went in the institution. We tend to think when we're students, or I can speak for myself, that we can escape our institution and we're good Americans, so we believe in individual liberty. But in reality, as my career kicks off and progresses, I realize that, man, I was really shaped by my institution in many more ways than I could ever fully realize. So I want to point that out this morning. And I know for maybe the search committee, boundary markers such as where a minister was trained was a pretty good indicator of what you would get if you were to hire that person. Even magazines such as Christianity Today, which was founded essentially by Billy Graham and another gentleman that taught at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, Carl Henry, were founded to rival Christian Century, which was a mainline publication. So again, you can kind of see that rivalry going on. What I find quite fascinating is how neo-evangelicalism has gone kind of, as it's become more mainstream, is kind of starting to go more the route of the mainline. And it'll be interesting to see over the coming decades what becomes of Christianity Today and these other institutions. One could argue from a Christian perspective that institutions rise and fall, and sometimes new institutions, again, kind of back to that free market mentality, new institutions need to be founded to keep the old institutions in check. Just to go back to last week, Westminster Theological Seminary, it's had some controversy, but it's really done a good job at guarding orthodoxy. So I have slide number 32 now, and as you can see, I have a few famous baby boomer preachers on there. I have on the top right-hand corner a picture of Bill Hybels when he was just starting Willow Creek. I don't know if he had a Jesus freak phase, but it seems like Willow Creek's really on hard times right now. But you can kind of see if you go back in every decade, Willow Creek had to be kind of involved with what was the newest and coolest trend. We have Rick Warren, who wrote Purpose Driven Life, which is a huge bookseller in the bottom left-hand corner. And then we have somebody who's a Dallas Theological Seminary grad who I critiqued in a sermon a couple weeks ago, I think in January, Andy Stanley. And these are the folks that I would say are kind of the baby boomers, the free marketers again, and you could define them as Big Eva, which is intended to be a joke over against big business. But this movement really, really exploded in the 1980s. And I don't think it's a bad thing. I would critique some of the forms that they use and sometimes call them crass. But they set up their churches institutionally, and Andy Stanley, actually, you know what? He's not a Southern Baptist. His dad is. But they might not have even realized this, but they set their institutions or their churches up over against the mainline. And I think sometimes personally that they stole a lot of transfer membership from the PCUSA or perhaps even EPC and PCA. And they would label them as conversion experiences, when in reality, I'm a little bit skeptical about that. But I don't even know sometimes if they realized how they competed. But I also had a professor at Dallas Theological Seminary, and his church grew. He was a Bible church. But one of the things that he did to the shame of the main line is he would intentionally look for mainliners. And what he would do is he would just start teaching them the Bible and their eyes would light up and he would say they would become Christians, but they were looking and starving for good, solid biblical preaching. And so they'd end up going to his church. So they would dump out of the main line into kind of the free church tradition. And in one way is I'm kind of sympathetic because when you stop preaching the gospel, you should just expect people to go to other churches. And a lot of these other free marketers or free church type of tradition, they have good biblical preaching. Often it's long. I often kind of laugh sometimes when I see churches who in the main line or maybe even the EPC who want to reach out to people, but then cut their sermons down to like 15 minutes. And I don't understand that. I think people really crave a good Bible-based sermon that's 30 to 40 minutes. So Christian radio grows in popularity because, again, back to this free market, Christian television becomes quite popular, which I know many of us are familiar with, and Christian branding. And you even have all these other weird types of Christian branding that comes up. The Christian bookstores just kind of blow up. So instead of having really great classical literature maybe to read on what is Christian formation, let's say the Puritans, for example, all these books that become dated in about 2 to 3 years start stockpiling up at half-price books. I know we don't have a half-price books here in Erie, but Sarah and I's first date was to half-price books in Dallas, and it was such a really interesting store because it's just a huge warehouse of used books that you can get for quite cheap. And one of the things that I like to do was go to the Christian aisle, and it was just absolutely depressing to read through all the books that people are reading, and they're like usually under $2, and they were just not worth buying at all. But one of the things that I'd like to critique about the free market, again, I'm not always against free market. That's our social context, and that's, we have to realize that that's kind of the milieu that we live in. But at the same time, I think we need to guard against manufacturing endless needs so we can have endless ministry needs, like single moms who are 30. You could go in the direction of, this really gets bad, I think, sometimes in age-segregated ministry. But instead of the focus being on worshiping the Lord, ministry ends up becoming commodified. And I think the three gentlemen on the slide are guilty of that. Again, they do great outreach to people, but at the same time, they push way too hard. And it can be sad when you have somebody like an Andy Stanley who calls for Christians to be unhitched from their Old Testaments because it's an embarrassment for non-believers. I don't really understand that. Okay, slide number 33. So where does the EPC fit in with neo-evangelicalism? And there's a picture that I took from the General Assembly when I was there. So the EPC is birthed within the movement of neo-evangelicalism and comes out of the main line. So this explains why the EPC can't really fit neatly into a box, but this requires that we know our story quite well. And what's interesting, when I went to General Assembly, the EPC can come across as just normal evangelicalism, but in our own presbytery, the Presbytery of the Alleghenies, we actually have quite a strong reputation for being quite Presbyterian in flavor. And I know this from networking with other teaching elders in the EPC who basically say ministering in the EPC in the South is just basically like being a Baptist. And they're really discouraged. And I say to them, you might want to apply to a POA church and come and transfer into our presbytery, because we have a rather Presbyterian form. Most churches are not Big Eva, as I called it in the last slide. Now, in my own generation, and I have slide 34 up right now, the biggest movement that I encountered when I was in college that I think has really shaped neo-evangelicalism and kind of pushed it into a more traditionalist trajectory. That's what I find really interesting about my generation, kind of over, perhaps even overreacting to the baby boomers in the kind of Willow Creek model, we now have a strong push towards confessionalism, to tradition, to singing hymns in church over against praise band music. It's really interesting that a lot of churches are trying to incorporate singing the Psalms. But the young, what was called the Young, Restless, and Reformed movement really shaped broader evangelicalism, and it pushed a lot of people such as myself into the Presbyterian tradition. This really kind of kicked off in 2010, and it's really shaped my generation, and I think it's going to long-term shape the EPC, especially as the EPC only partners with evangelical institutions to train their ministers. I know Reformed Theological Seminary is a big one right now. But as that becomes the dominant place where people are trained, I expect the EPC to become more conservative, at least theologically. I could be proven wrong in the future, as I often am, but I think that the movement, the Young, Restless, and Reform, is really going to shape the EPC in a different framework going forward, especially as the baby boomers retire and we get a lot of newer, younger ministers. I think things are going to change. So what was weird on the campus of Liberty and Dallas Theological Seminary is hipster Calvinist pastors started springing up all over the place. So they're wearing their skinny jeans and having cool glasses and talking about John Calvin all the time, which was really quite interesting. Although they never read him, they just read about him and assumed a lot about him. They never actually picked up the institutes and read them. But the two key figures that we're going to kind of talk about this morning that influenced this movement would have been Tim Keller and John Piper. And I personally spent hours in particular listening to John Piper. There's two other figures that were younger that had a pretty big influence. One still does and one does not. Mark Driscoll was really popular when I was in college and into seminary at a kind of a moral failing, a bullying type of thing. But his podcast, I remember when he was preaching, shot up into like the top five. He got in trouble for embezzling money from his church to buy his book. But nonetheless, he was really popular. And then somebody who's still quite a good preacher by the name of Matt Chandler, who I've mentioned before. If I remember correctly, Dylan Gearing liked to listen to Matt Chandler a lot when I talked to him. And he's been really influential on the Young, Restless, and Reform movement, which has kind of died out. People have gone on to the new thing, which appears to be at this time period, social justice. And then because it's always, again, back to the free market thing, one thing to the next. There's always kind of something that needs to be done next. So that free market mentality pushes people to go and care about a new thing every decade. So from about 2010 to 2019, Calvinism was really popular. That's kind of waning as ministers went in the more traditionalist route, such as myself. So again, Tim Keller and John Piper kind of launched that. But as you can pull up slide 35, you can see that R.C. Sproul was another famous person, and I know many of us are familiar with his works. I know the Molks had dinner with him before he ever became really popular. I know he did a lot of work with the CCO from when he first started. But Sproul was one of the original framers of the PCA. He fashioned himself in a pastor-theologian kind of model. He went and did a PhD at Free University and went on to found ministries that have had a huge influence on the EPC, the PCA, and many other Reformed-like people where they have Ligonier ministries. So it's popularized Presbyterian and Reformed Christianity. From what I understand, they even have cruises that Ligonier sponsors where you can go on for a whole entire week. If you love Reformed theology, you can go and study it for a whole entire week on a cruise ship. I love Reformed theology, but the thought of wedding together a cruise and learning about Reformed theology is not something I would personally like, but I have some pastor friends that would like to go on those types of cruises. So John Piper, on slide number 36. I would personally argue, and I still listen to his sermons occasionally when I get stuck, I would argue John Piper is the greatest preacher of his generation, personally. I saw him preach once in person, and I've never to this day heard such powerful preaching. He kind of, not to sound over the top, but kind of glowed when he preached. I mean, he's just somebody that's so focused on the text. The text has mastered him. He's by no means perfect, but at the same time, he's a really, really good preacher. And the thing that I've always loved and appreciated about him is, even if I disagree with him on a certain interpretation of a verse or a text, it's the fact that he is somebody who does Bible preaching really, really well. And he's somebody that I've looked up to. He's been retired for a couple years, but his website, Desiring God, is fantastic. They have a lot of really great content on there. And he's somebody that's the real deal. I mean, he lives in a house that's not big, and he's so popular. He shops at Goodwill for his clothes. He's just a really fantastic guy. I know him and his wife adopted, and they had 4 boys, I believe. A funny story about John Piper. I had a friend that went to Moody Bible Institute with one of his sons, and I don't know if I'd actually feel comfortable doing what John Piper did, but one of his sons said, I'd like to write a book about living homeless on the streets of Chicago for a whole summer. And Piper said, hey, that would be great. As long as you stay safe, I think you should go ahead and do it and write about your experience. So it'd be interesting to have a dad that would, I know my dad would not tell me to do that. So that's always an interesting Piper story that my friend Kevin told me. He went on to found Bethlehem Theological Seminary, and I've heard from many students that have went there, they tend to convert from the Baptist tradition to Presbyterianism, which I personally find really interesting. Piper was really the first figure that, after hours of listening to his sermons — I couldn't really get enough of his sermons when I was 19 and started really wanting to learn the Bible well, but he preaches through books of the Bible. I think sometimes he might have did topical series, but he's somebody that convinced me that preaching through the books of the Bible is kind of the way to go about things. It instructs people to read their Bible well. It instructs people. It's the way that a lot of the church has done it throughout history. John Calvin did it that way. Ulrich Zwingli did it that way. Even Thomas Aquinas preached through books of the Bible, and Augustine did as well. We often hear the lectionary is the most ancient, but in reality, Lectio Continua is the most ancient form of preaching. So he kind of convinced me and pushed me in the direction to preach through books of the Bible. On slide 37, we have an interesting figure, Tim Keller. So Tim Keller is probably the most influential figure in the EPC for his writings. You can hear Zoe in the background talking. She's listening to the teaching this week. But Tim Keller, again, he's one of the most influential figures in the EPC. His book Center Church, for example, I know is recommended by the Presbytery to read through as a church. I personally, like Tim Keller, but I've also noticed when people attach to his way of doing ministry and his techniques, they have a tendency to want to try to copycat their success in New York City. And I personally don't think that makes a lot of sense, because New York City — he even says this in his writings, because I've read quite a few of his books — New York City is not America. He's even said that, and I totally agree. New York City is a pretty unique place. It's a transnational city, so to speak. And if you were to go to New York City and then go to, like, Pittsburgh, for example, or Buffalo or Cleveland, you'd have a totally different experience, and that's really not what Heartland America is like. So I'm always skeptical of people that can latch on to somebody's success like Tim Keller in New York City and want to do it, say, in Erie, for example. I don't know if that's the wisest move. Another thing to realize with Tim Keller is, I actually have some friends that are PCA ministers who planted a church in Pittsburgh. And I think a lot of people are not aware of this, but there's one church in the PCA in particular, which I've actually been there to worship before. It's called Park City Presbyterian Church. It's in Dallas, Texas. Most of the people that go there are multimillionaires because they're oil tycoons. I never saw so many flashy cars until I lived in Dallas. right around the specific area where I used to go to Starbucks and study, for example. But in this one church, they are so wealthy that they essentially fund all church plants in the PCA. What a lot of people don't realize is there was millions and millions and millions of dollars behind Redeemer in New York City. And if you have a lot of money and you have good connections with parachurch organizations, which they did, they started out with about 120 seasoned people who had spent time in InterVarsity, I know, and you have all this cash behind you, you really can be successful. And so sometimes from my friends in the PCA that told me this, who were trying to plant a church in Lawrenceville in Pittsburgh and were successful, it's really nice to read about Tim Keller and his success, but at the same time, there was a lot of cash behind them, and there was also a lot of support. Literally, the whole denomination came behind Tim Keller's church plant in New York City and said, we want this church plant to succeed in the PCA. So I'd always say that, yes, it was a movement of the Spirit, but also at the same time, they had a lot of resources that the average church plant, such as ourselves, could only dream of. So to try to always put things again in social context. And I'd also say that the transformational model that Tim Keller kind of espouses is not for everyone. Put a strong emphasis on that. And I think even the arts, for example, and I think even perhaps this current COVID crisis has taught us, maybe the Lord is calling us back to a more traditional way of sharing the gospel, which is gathering on Sunday mornings through the proclamation and through the sacraments. And I would probably advocate a more confessionalist response. Not to say that we're not to be a blessing to our neighbors through founding ministries and helping other people, but I think maybe the Lord is perhaps calling us back to a more traditional understanding of what the church is for. And the church is primarily a worshiping community. We are called to bless our neighbors, but at the same time, I think one of the critiques that could go down on Tim Keller is he ends up creating a more this-worldly form of Christianity, where I think John Piper, I even listened to a sermon of him recently, focuses on a more otherworldly reality. And you can definitely tell this when you listen to both of their sermons, and I would probably say that I would favor John Piper's preaching more. And again, John Piper is more of a, I don't know what you would call it, a traditionalist, so to speak. So now I'm on slide 38. So in conclusion, that is a picture of the Revelation 7-11 task force. So there's a few issues, I think, that are going forward for the Evangelical Presbyterian Church. And I think it'll be really interesting to see how they play themselves out over the next coming decade or two. So number one is social justice. So the EPC has a task force named the Revelation 7-11 Task Force, and they are going to implement their vision at the next General Assembly. And from what I gather, I don't really know where. I probably fall somewhere in the middle on what they're going to recommend for churches to do. But feelings, by and large, are quite mixed on this, and some people are a little bit worried, especially ministers that have come out of the Presbyterian Church USA, a little bit worried about the EPC attaching ourselves onto social justice issues, and does that really replay, say, the Confession of 67 and all this talk about the Ministry of Reconciliation? So it'll be interesting when I go to General Assembly, assuming they don't postpone it, how things unfold with the social justice issues. Some people have strong feelings about diversity. Some people are pro, you would say, and some people are against it. And some churches that are in rural settings, it really doesn't affect them at all. But this is really being pushed pretty strong at the General Assembly level. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out. The second one is transition. So how do we transition from the leadership of the baby boomers, as we saw in the first picture of the slide, to the Gen Xers and the millennials? That's kind of a big thing. I don't know if a lot of us realize this, but over the next basically 5 to 10 years, we're going to have about 70% new pastors in the EPC, and that's going to shape our institution in many different ways. So it makes me a little bit nervous because I'm kind of a pessimistic more than optimistic. But at the same time, I go back to the Young Restless and Reform movement, and I tend to think, personally, that that movement will have a good shaping force on our denomination in the future. I can kind of see that already with the younger Gen Xers and millennial pastors, so it'll be really interesting to see how this transition takes place and what the EPC looks like under the leadership of the Xers and the millennials a decade or two from now. And finally, I think one of the biggest issues is, after we've gone through all this, as a Presbyterian denomination, are we going to hold on to our confessional identity, or are we going to just be pragmatic? And I think those are kind of the two big themes that we've seen throughout this month as we work through American Presbyterianism. How does the EPC navigate being Reformed, and how does it navigate being evangelical? Because trying to mix those two together and be balanced is really, really hard. From what I've seen, you kind of swing one way or the other. And I've already seen sometimes that the motto of the EPC and all things charity can be used to just talk about being pragmatic all the time. And I don't, that kind of rubs me the wrong way sometimes, because I think we need to personally take our confession quite serious, and our, as teaching elders, our ordination vows quite serious. So those are kind of the big three that I think are big three issues that are facing the EPC going forward. So in conclusion, on slide 39, American religion and Presbyterians need to realize that the free market mentality was there from the beginning and will always be a part of our experience. And I think we need to realize that when we think about birthing new ministries to bless our neighbors. Some people could be like, well, that's kind of consumeristic or kind of crass to think about. Is this a specific target audience that we want to go after? And I would reply, we can't escape the free market mentality. It's with us. It's a part of who we are. So many of our choices in the day-to-day trenches in life are all about free markets, essentially. So we are not going to be able to escape that reality. Another really interesting one is, since Billy Graham passed away a few years ago, what happens to evangelicalism? It really, and that does influence the EPC, because it seems like to me right now it's kind of up for grabs, and nobody's really emerged, such as Billy Graham, to kind of have a stronghold on evangelicalism. If you go all the way back to slide number one, and I talked about George Marston, one of his funny quotes that I really like, because he spent his whole life studying Presbyterians and evangelicals, is he says to himself, or somebody asked him, how do you define evangelicalism? And he said, however Billy Graham just defines it. He just kind of threw up his arms in frustration. And I've always thought that's quite funny. So it's interesting to see how the broader movement will morph and change over the coming decades. And finally, the church has its own culture. And I think we need to realize that we are different, we are weird. Paul often talks about the world not understanding us. And I think we need to realize that as a church. And I think we're starting to go into territory where the church is just not as important as it used to be. And that's okay. The Lord is sovereign. The church in the global south is doing really, really well. Our brothers and sisters in Christ in the Presbyterian Church in Mexico are doing great. I think this is kind of a season of winnowing, so to speak, in the American church. And I think we need to get ready for churches to be just a little bit smaller than they might have been in our experience. The call of the minister, and I think rolling elders and churches in general, is to be faithful in the world that we find ourselves in. And perhaps I'm just wrong. Perhaps COVID-19 and the current crisis that we are in right now could totally change things, and we could have a great renewal. Notice I didn't use the word revival, but renewal in the church, and a zealous nature for Presbyterians to share the gospel with their neighbors. I remember our current moderator, Case Thorpe, said in the 1920s, I believe, Presbyterians were actually known for a couple years for being pretty zealous for their evangelism. And one of my prayers for our denomination is that we would regain that zealous nature for the gospel again. So thank you for your time. I hope you've enjoyed these slides and this presentation. If you have any questions over the 4 weeks, feel free to just give me a call, text me your question, or email me. It's been a real pleasure. I miss not being able to talk to you guys through these slides. It feels a little bit weird just teaching to the screen. But at the same time, if you have any questions or disagreements or want to chat about something, feel free to give me a contact. Thank you.